Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of September. In our continuing series on healthcare reform, this hour of the program, we're going to talk about Healthy San Francisco. When you enroll in Healthy San Francisco, you choose a medical home, the medical facility that will provide your basic medical care. It is a program that provides insurance for many, many people. 94% of participants in San Francisco's unique universal health care program are at least somewhat satisfied with it, and 92% would recommend it to other people. Those are the findings of a report released in August by the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's an ambitious healthcare legislation. It went into effect early last year, and it means that San Francisco and Massachusetts are the only near universal healthcare programs in the United States. This hour of the program, we're going to find out how Healthy San Francisco actually works and why it is something that the city of San Francisco thought would be good for the city, how it's affected employees and employers, those who have insurance, those who are uninsured. Our guest is Dr. Sandra Hernandez, who is CEO of the San Francisco Foundation. And that she has served as Director of Public Health for the city and county of San Francisco. She's an assistant clinical professor at the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine and also has an active clinical practice at San Francisco General Hospital in the AIDS Clinic. We welcome phone calls for Dr. Hernandez. The phone number here, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandra Hernandez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Tell me why San Francisco decided that it needed to provide almost universal health care coverage to the citizens of the city.
Well, you know, I think there's two elements to that. One is that San Francisco is blessed to have a very strong healthcare delivery system. We have the University of California, San Francisco is a major provider, Catholic Healthcare West, Kaiser, and then all the Sutter hospitals, in addition to a number of independent hospitals. And then we've got a very strong network of primary care clinics, so-called federally qualified health centers. And so, we're a city with about 85,000 uninsured with no medical home, in spite of the fact that we have a very strong delivery system. And I think we had the leadership elected as well as in the business community and certainly advocates to say we should be able to design a system where we could get everyone in the system enrolled in a medical home. And that's what we set out to do with an advisory body that met for about 120 days to really think about how could we go about reconfiguring our delivery system and our financial system to a certain extent to be able to include everybody within it.
And tell me why there were 85,000 people uninsured. Who were the uninsured in San Francisco?
That's a great question. The uninsured, not unlike the uninsured throughout the rest of the country, tends to come in sort of two large demographics. There are young people who have emancipated into adulthood and for whom their family insurance or their parents' insurance will no longer cover them. Some insurance policies that may happen at 21, others that may happen at 24. But essentially, these are young adults who are either not formally in the workplace or if they are, they're part-time. They might be part-time students. By and large, a healthy population, and when you think actuarially about getting everyone in the system, it's why, you know, the conversation nationally right now is around an individual mandate. You really want everyone in the system in part to help you spread risk across the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one demographic. I think the other important demographic are people who are working in many cases one or two, sometimes three jobs, part-time jobs, and are in a workplace situation where they are not compensated enough to be able to take advantage of health insurance that might be offered by employees, and or they don't have the purchasing power. They might be independent consultants. They may work for themselves, don't really have the purchasing power to go into the insurance market and be able to afford those insurance packets and packages that are available to them. And so that's a significant part of the population that is uninsured.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like many cities, we have some folks who are newcomers to the city, and while they may come through various clinics that the city runs, they're not eligible for any of the Medi-Cal programs, Medicaid programs that might be available. So that's kind of the gamut. We did a very thorough analysis of this population that was uninsured, really trying to understand what kind of health costs they might have. And also, importantly, some of these folks were interfacing with the healthcare system, but they were interfacing regularly through the emergency room.
Oh, sure.
And so one of the major motivations by the healthcare providers and the hospitals themselves was to get these folks into a primary care setting with a medical home and really a place where they can schedule more appropriate visits for what their needs are and really decompress what are very stressed emergency rooms.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about a medical home, can you explain that more to me, Dr. Hernandez?
Well, the principle is really a very, very simple one. If you have health insurance, you, generally speaking, have a pediatrician for your children, and you may have a family practitioner or an internist, sometimes an OBGYN, who is your physician that you call both for regular checkups to go in and get a pap smear or go in and get a colonoscopy if that's a screening test that you should be doing, or if you're, you know, concerned that you have the flu. Or if you, you develop a rash, or so that you have a medical home, a place where you would call. Usually there's a triage system associated with those delivery systems. You get in and you see a physician who has seen you before and have seen you over a period of time and ideally has seen you and your family over a period of time. And the notion there is that these are we call primary care physicians who are trained in seeing a broad array of acute conditions and have a great deal of experience in managing chronic medical conditions, which, as you know, is an increasing part of what we're seeing in healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea would be that you could get in there on a regular basis, establish a relationship. Maybe you need to exercise more. Maybe you need to improve your diet. Maybe you need to stop smoking. And those kinds of health care maintenance, preventative kinds of conversations would also happen in these medical homes. And so you really begin to empower a patient to have advocacy with their provider, and also you have a provider who begins to understand you and your particular medical profile and really can help you develop active plans for staying healthy.
And those chronic conditions that you talked about, if we have pretty thorough prevention, a lot of those could be avoided, and we spend a huge amount of money on those conditions, don't we, in this country?
We do. The CDC has estimated that, chronic diseases represents upwards of, two-thirds
Wow.
of the cost in our healthcare system. And, the problem, chronic diseases in and of themselves are not good, but the morbidity that's associated with those, the loss of productivity in the workforce, these are all very heavy societal costs that we bear. And so I think the idea of a medical home is that a physician can really begin to work with a patient individually, and whether it's, a regular exercise regime or whether it's better management of their blood sugar if they're diabetic, or if it's, better and early management of asthma in children, these are all conditions that we have very good scientific and medical evidence about how to manage them so that people don't lose days in school, don't lose days in the workplace, and really aren't, you know, finding themselves in emergency rooms or intensive care units from things that are ultimately much better managed in an outpatient setting in a good relationship between a primary care provider and the patient.
So the next obvious question is, how do you pay for it?
Well, it's a great question, Kathleen. And, you know, we did a couple of things as part of our planning for Healthy San Francisco. And one of them, and, you know, this is an important thing to do, and, you know, the country's in a big debate about this now, but you really need to understand where you're spending dollars now. And that was a very important part of the background research we did with our planning body, which was to say that the city and county of San Francisco was using a significant amount of city taxpayer dollars to support the primary care clinics, the hospital, the emergency room. And patients who didn't have a medical home would go and utilize these, again, without great transparency into exactly what costs they were going to incur, how much subsidy was coming from taxpayer dollars, and the like. So one of the things we tried to do first and foremost was understand where we were spending existing dollars. We knew that very low-income families were going to require a subsidy to be able to enroll into Healthy San Francisco. And before we tried to tie a subsidy to certain income levels, we wanted to try to understand where the tax subsidy dollars were in the system to begin with, and that was a very important part of our research. And then the second part of it was to say that, and this is part of the conversation that's going on in our national healthcare reform that we're in the midst of nationally, and that is to really try to get the entire business community. And in particular, we spent a lot of time trying to understand the economics of small business owners.
Mm-hmm.
We had small business owners that were sitting at the table when we were doing this planning and saying, look, we really want to offer health insurance to our employees and our workers. I remember walking into our dry cleaners, our local dry cleaners, a family-run business with largely women over the age of 50, and they want to be able to have health insurance for themselves, their family members, and the like. So there was no question about the motivation of the business community. And this was true whether you were talking from the Restaurant Association, the Chamber of Commerce, or the small businesses that were sitting at the table. They were very forthcoming in saying, look, we have very narrow margins in our business. And so we want to be able to participate, but we also want to be able to be a viable business. And so we spent a great deal of time trying to understand how we could begin to level the playing field, as we refer to it, so that everybody was participating in Healthy San Francisco in one fashion or another. And so the options through Healthy San Francisco from the employer participation point of view is one of two ways. You could either offer dollar value dollar value subsidies to workers so that they themselves could buy into Healthy San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
or an employer could make a contribution to Healthy San Francisco that would be in part added to by the city tax dollars that I mentioned earlier that were already subsidizing a very high-end, inefficient, inappropriate place for those dollars. Now, the nice thing about San Francisco is you actually can pretty much get your arms around all of our business community, all of our delivery system, and have these conversations about how do you re-incentivize where the dollars go. One of the most important things we did was we created transparency with regard to the options for medical homes. So if you went to Clinic X that's in your neighborhood, you would know exactly what services you would get for the dollars that you were buying.
Mm.
And in the past, people would come into those clinics and would have no idea how much they were going to be charged as a copay, whether copay was going to be collected, whether they would be eligibilized for Medicaid. Those were just not seen to the consumer. And I think one of the important things we did was we asked all of the clinics to show what they were currently charging for copays, what kind of information was necessary, and then what the consumer would get if you chose this clinic as opposed to that clinic. And a city that has tremendous variations in language and culture, we wanted to make sure that people had the opportunity to choose a clinic where someone, if they didn't speak English, could see a provider that spoke the language that they needed to get their health care delivered in. And so to get culturally competent care and get medical homes, we also wanted to create transparency with regard to what providers would provide within this spectrum. And then what we did was again, we had tremendous support from our healthcare foundations, the California Healthcare Foundation, the Kaiser Foundation, the Blue Shield Foundation. These were all folks who had done research on this and brought their research and their analytics to the table. And so I want to really call out that we had a tremendous amount of philanthropic research that was added to our deliberations. And one of the things that we became very aware of through all of this research is people want choice about where they go for their care, but they also want to know what they're going to get for what they're paying. Mm-hmm. Creating that transparency in the system ended up being a very powerful part of what we did. In the end, when we completed the planning for Healthy San Francisco, an ordinance was passed, and important to note from a political perspective, we have an 11-member board of supervisors, so we are a city and a county. We have supervisors and a mayor for the city. This was an ordinance that was passed by all 11 members
of the
supervisors, and of course was signed into law by our mayor enthusiastically. The one thing you should know about this program is that it's not technically an insurance program. And what I mean by that is you enroll in Healthy San Francisco, you get a medical home. If you need a subsidy for that, that subsidy comes in some part from the city's dollars that were already going into the system and in some part for the business contributions that are now required by the city ordinance. However, if you find yourself on vacation somewhere or out of the city or even across the bay, this program is not portable. So unlike people who have insurance, if I go to, somewhere and I get a very bad flu or I get, something very serious and I end up in an emergency room, my insurance is going to pay for that. Healthy San Francisco is really a medical home focused in San Francisco only. It is not what we call portable. And therefore, it's not truly insurance in the typical fashion. However, the one thing we did was we said, let's not recreate any wheels. We had many years ago developed a nonprofit HMO to take care of the Medicaid population that was increasingly moving into HMO settings by virtue of state policy. That is a pre-existing health plan, nonprofit health plan, focused on the Medicaid population principally and a little bit our SCHIP program. And we said, let's have that HMO administer Healthy San Francisco. So they would collect payments, and they would also do the assignments for medical home, as well as all the education that you and I get from our health insurance providers. And so what we did was we leveraged an existing entity that had many of the functional capabilities to run Healthy San Francisco and not have to start a new program entirely from scratch. That, too, is part of the conversation that we're having now nationally. Do we have a so-called public plan? And or do we do some kind of co-ops? And a lot of interest has been directed towards Healthy San Francisco to sort of say, gee, what did they do there so that you didn't have to start by financing and creating an entirely new infrastructure? And that's one of the things we did in Healthy San Francisco, but not technically an insurance program.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you in a moment. Our guest is Dr. Sandra Hernandez, Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Foundation. She's also served as the Director of Public Health for the City and County of San Francisco, teaches where she is Assistant Clinical Professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. She also has a clinical practice at San Francisco General Hospital in the AIDS Clinic. And we're talking about Healthy San Francisco, this remarkable program in San Francisco that provides, it's an ambitious healthcare reform, and it provides near universal coverage for the people who live in the city. She's talked about how it is organized, and we are welcoming your phone calls for her if you want details of this program. And we are asking the question, are there things that we can learn about covering everybody by examining San Francisco? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you certainly are welcome to do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, we'll be talking about the five gutsiest world leaders, people who are breaking the rules, changing our minds, and shaping our future. That's the second hour of the program. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, for you to learn about Healthy San Francisco. And our guest is Dr. Sandra Hernandez, Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Foundation. Any questions you have about specifics of this plan or what we may be able to learn from it when we debate national reform would be pertinent. We start our calls with Jill from Green Bay. Hi, Jill.
Hello, ladies. I have a comment and a question. When we talk about employment-based health insurance, is there some financial advantage, such as a tax credit or rebate, to these companies so that actually it's not as big a cost as it appears to be? And in support of public health insurance, I am on disability. I had been insulin dependent for 5 years. I have private insurance primary through my husband's work and Social Security for myself. And for 5 years, I could hardly get out of bed. And to be brief, I was taking over 250 units of insulin with no improvement in my blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C. Medicare, in order for me to be eligible for an insulin pump, required specific blood tests that I, as an RN, had never even heard about. And I found out that I was actually an autoimmune disease. I do not, I have an autoimmune antibody to an enzyme that is necessary to the glucose metabolism process, and also an insulin antibody. And I have felt now that I have woken up. And so when everybody says, you know, government insurance is not important, you know, I was seeing an endocrinologist, and she never even suggested these tests. It was in order for me to be eligible for Medicare and considered for that insulin pump. So, that, you know, that's important for those things to get out, too.
Dr. Hernandez.
Well, thank you for your call. You know, I think you mentioned Medicare and the rules associated with Medicare, whether it's for durable medical equipment like a pump, as you're referring to. And a significant part of the conversation right now is really how to restructure the flow of dollars to be able to, you know, take a set of services for people who have you know, insulin-dependent diabetes or other types of chronic diseases, and really be able to put the dollars not so much in a visit or in an exam, but really try to say we will compensate the delivery system and the delivery of care for getting the right outcome. That is, your hemoglobin A1C goes down and your blood sugar is much better managed, and therefore you have fewer complications resulting from your diabetes. And that conversation is well underway, and I think there's a very strong sense that, you know, Medicare reform in this kind of way has a lot of promise for taking dollars out of you know, quantity of visits or numbers of procedures, and really putting it on what's the outcome we want to see as a result of our dollars with patients who have chronic diseases such as yours. And you obviously have a number of unique characteristics associated with that. So that's one point. On your first part of your question, there are many corporations and businesses that are global and or based in the U.S. that have really very strong workplace practices trying to keep employees working actively to stay healthy, and the workplace is trying to support that. And in a number of the bills that are working their way through Congress, there would be incentives and or efforts to try to draw out those kinds of innovations in the workplace, to call them out and to celebrate them. I was at a meeting last week at Intel down here in the peninsula in Northern California, and they have a fabulous program where all employees are offered the opportunity to get some just screening blood work, and then they meet with a personal medical coach who develops a plan, whether it's for exercising at noon or for reducing tobacco or reducing stress, as a wellness mechanism. And I think, you know, one of the pieces that is being discussed quite a bit, but which doesn't yet have a lot of financial resources around it, is what do we do to promote wellness throughout our society? And obviously, employers of all sizes have a role to play in that. Mm-hmm. And so at the moment, there's not a lot of financial remuneration that comes back through tax dollars to businesses for that work, that kind of workplace program. But I think what we're trying to say is that, you know, we have an important role for government to play in Medicare and Medicaid, and expansion of Medicaid is another part of health care reform. We have an important thing to do in our schools and in our workplaces to promote wellness and to do primary prevention. You know, we know how to prevent coronary artery disease. These are things that that I think we need a much stronger societal culture change to be able to promote wellness, much as we've done with tobacco. I mean, it's societally much, much more difficult to be a smoker today than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And if you think about what it took to move that, I mean, you know, children, school-age children will tell you, you know, why are you smoking? You know, that'll kill you. Mm-hmm. And that kind of consciousness is something we need people to take individual responsibility for themselves being healthier. We need much more workplace incentives for people to stay healthy and productive in the workforce. And increasingly, we need to put dollars into primary prevention and into wellness so that we can reduce, you know, the future costs on these programs going forward. As chronic diseases are going to are continuing to grow and people live longer, I think a lot more engagement at all points in our society around thinking about wellness is warranted.
I was listening to an NPR report, I think last week, Dr. Hernandez, that said that even though the program Healthy San Francisco is relatively new, that people who are in the plan are going to the hospital much less often. When they get to the hospital, how long they stay there has now been cut in half. That's significant.
It is, and you know, nobody wants to be in an emergency room. I just don't know anybody who says, you know, I'm going to go spend the afternoon
right
in the emergency room waiting to see a doctor. Nobody wants to be institutionalized in hospitals. I mean, we need hospitals, and we get extraordinarily good care from them, and a lot of innovations come from our delivery system. But the fact of the matter is, you know, if we're going to get a handle on the percent rise every year of our gross national product that's going into health care costs, really, really exorbitant. I mean, the crisis that we have in this country is dramatic increases in costs, really unabated and nowhere near what our CPI is. And at the same time, fewer and fewer people being able to afford to stay in the health insurance have products that are affordable to them. And that's what people describe as what's really unsustainable about our current system. I think that, you know, the notion that a medical home will allow people to get appropriate care in the appropriate setting at the appropriate time is a very important concept for trying to design this. I mean, one of the other things we realized, we've got all these primary care clinics in San Francisco, but lo and behold, none of them were open after 5, and none of them were open on Saturday and Sunday. So for people who are, but emergency rooms are open 24/7, 365 days out of the year. Mm-hmm. And so these are the kinds of things that you look at and you say, oh, well, you know, there's a reason why emergency rooms are crazy on Saturday, because you've been sick since Wednesday, but you had to go to work Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. And so by the time you get to the ER on Saturday, your glucose is really out of control, or your asthma has really severely been exacerbated. And so the notion of appropriate care at the appropriate place at the appropriate time will reduce the number of people who are getting regular care out of emergency rooms, and leave emergency rooms for people who had a very serious car accident or had some head trauma, or and use emergency rooms and the skills and the costs associated with that for the people who most need that. You know, these are very unpredictable types of situations, our trauma centers, our burn centers, those kinds of things.
Right.
And I think that that's the principle expanded around a medical home.
Jill, thanks for the call. Dr. Brian from Pewaukee. Hi, Dr. Brian.
Yes, good morning, Joy. Thank you for the show. And I'm interested in learning, if you're aware, doctor, that we already have an army of primary health care providers who are trained, skilled, licensed, indemnified in providing the best primary care. Study after study, comparative research has proven that chiropractic has this benefit. What is the chiropractic inclusion in the San Francisco plan, please?
It's a great question, and I agree with you. There's an important role for the practice of chiropractic medicine. I have a fabulous chiropractor, by the way, who has helped me tremendously manage my chronic migraines. The San Francisco Health Plan, Healthy San Francisco, what we did was we designed a benefit package that was very comparable to Medicare. And in fact, when we priced this to try to understand what it would cost over time, we assumed that payments would mirror those roughly of Medicare. And so obviously, full-fledged primary care is covered in Healthy San Francisco. We've talked a lot about that. Acute care, hospitalizations, emergency room visits are fully covered, as is all behavioral health. Really important to note that that mental health is an important part of the benefits of Healthy San Francisco. So if you're acutely depressed, or you have chronic depression, or you have a serious mental illness, that is all covered under Healthy San Francisco and managed out of your medical home. I do want to mention that as we talk nationally about health care reform, over the years, partly because of the cost of going to medical school, we've seen, for example, in the pediatric practice of medicine, that pediatricians tend to go into the specialty arenas. And so one of the things that we're concerned about is really needing to refocus resources around people taking a primary care track. People may leave medical school today with upwards of $130,000 of debt, and then go into a primary care setting where they may make $90,000 a year and carrying a heavy load of debt from medical school. And I think one of the concerns that we have is to make sure that we've got the supply of pediatricians going forward and primary care physicians going forward. And so we think, you know, having a comprehensive set of benefits, prevention, primary care, medical home, acute care, as well as mental health, is all part of Healthy San Francisco. What we did not cover in Healthy San Francisco was vision and dental care. And dental care is clearly, as is vision, you know, we shouldn't separate out parts of our body. But under Healthy San Francisco, we were largely focused on physical health and mental health.
Thanks, Dr. Brian. Let's go to Kathy from Monroe. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Joy. Thank you for the show.
Kathleen,
and I just want to start by saying that I support a public option, and I applaud San Francisco for their efforts here. My comment is really about the increase in healthcare costs and your guest comment about transparency and consumers wanting to know what they're paying for. I am a middle-class family. I have two children, and I recently took my daughter to the pediatrician that is our family care provider. Mm-hmm. She was there for 5 minutes for a rash. The doctor looked at her, said, nothing to worry about, Mom, sent us home. And 2 weeks later, I got a bill for $200.
Oh, my.
When I called the medical practitioner's billing office, the comment that I got was, well, your insurance paid for it. And I said, I want to know why it was $200 for this five-minute visit. And they said, well, we can't tell you that. We have to send it to a review committee who will look at the coding, and then they will send you a letter on whether or not it was a valid charge. And I guess that just shocked and surprised me that I could not be told why a five-minute visit cost me $200. And so that transparency issue, I think, is important to all consumers. And it really makes you feel like there is, I guess, a culture of secrecy around what we're paying for here.
Well, I think that, you know, it's less, I think, frankly, about secrecy. It's more that, again, there are not greatly, you know, people describe our healthcare reform system as not being a system. And it's not a system in that the rationale and the transparency and the logic for, you know, looking at, you know, you might get a statement from your insurance provider, look at it and say, what do all these codes mean? I do think that one of the things we need to do, again, to get control of utilization and cost, is to have consumers have a lot more information about these kinds of things, making decisions about what kind of health care coverage you might need, what's a high deductible plan, what are the scenarios that might enroll from a high deductible plan. You know, we have a lot of our health care expenditures that are flat out of pocket. We have, medical savings plans. You have flexible savings plans. And really creating a much stronger consumer literacy to understand what you're being billed, what you're covered for, what you're not covered for, all of those things really we need to get much better at strengthening the consumer's view of that, with the notion that people will make smarter decisions. And that's not to say, you know, if your child has a rash, you should take her to be seen by a pediatrician. That's the right thing to do. In fact, you know, I'm a physician, and my pediatrician for our daughter said, let's be clear, I'm the doctor, you're the mother. She's got a problem, you call me. So, you know, taking your daughter to see a pediatrician is the right thing to do. These coding and what you get coded for and therefore what gets billed, how much gets billed to the insurance, how much gets billed to you, there is tremendous variability which creates a lot of confusion and frustration by consumers who are trying to be good consumers of healthcare and do the right thing by their children and their family. And I think, you know, there's a significant movement towards more transparency, more simplicity, and more rationality in consumer participation in buying and choosing both insurance and care for their families. So it is an important thing we need. We have a lot more work to do in that regard.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Sandra Hernandez. We're talking about Healthy San Francisco. The program was started over a year ago, and it has been very successful in ensuring the vast majority, almost universal health care coverage now in San Francisco. And we've been talking about how it's set up with the medical homes, how it is paid for, and asking whether or not we ought to examine their system much more closely to see if there are parts of it that would work for a national plan. And we'll ask Dr. Hernandez that very question in just one moment. Our phone lines have been busy. There's one opening right now, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Dr. Sandra Hernandez, and we go back to phone calls now. Rich is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the program. I do want to applaud you, Doctor, and also San Francisco for at least taking a step forward in this business. My question is a little bit off that topic, though. Is back in 1975, I believe it was, I had a hernia surgery up here in Wisconsin, and I spent 7 days in the hospital. I mean, I was catered to. It was more like Club Med than it was a hospital stay. Approximately 10 years later, I had the right side hernia show up for me, and I went to the hospital. I went in at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was home by 1 o'clock. After experience of the pain of the first operation, you know, approximately 10 years earlier, I'm thinking, boy, this is not going to be good. But then I looked at it with open eyes and said, you know, if this is the path that the medical profession's heading down, this is wonderful. We're going to be saving, you know, millions upon millions of dollars. And then kind of the next thing I see is about every hospital I drive by is adding on 200,000 square foot wing here, an office complex over there, and just nothing but building and building. And I guess I'm confused. I thought that the hospital stays were shorter, that the hospitals would actually get smaller.
Well, it's a very good question. You know, in California, where we are very prone to earthquakes, we've got a state law that's requiring hospitals that don't meet current earthquake standards to fully rebuild these hospitals all across the state beginning in 2012-2013. And so there's a significant amount of capital that's flowing to, as you say, bricks and mortar, to upgrade these hospitals and make them safe from a seismic point of view. And the fact of the matter is we use a lot of resources to make sure our hospitals are of the size and also have the capacity for the new innovations in technology that that are happening, appropriately so, through new innovations and new technologies. And, you know, there are some hospitals that because we have much more what we call quaternary care, so this is, you know, transplants, open heart surgeries, neurosurgeries, very sophisticated technologies and procedures for people who, you know, candidly in the past, we didn't have a lot of things to offer them by way of curative or even extending life. You know, what you're seeing is in many of these hospitals is a move towards more ICU beds or pediatric intensive care beds or neonatal intensive care beds. These are in relationship to our effort to extend life to very, you know, to preemies, to do very directed surgeries at malignancies, and so it's not. I mean, a hernia is a pretty straightforward procedure. Hernia repairs, And doesn't surprise me at all that that you were in and out within a day. And there's a lot of movement towards what we call same-day surgeries. So you come in the morning, you have the procedure in your home by that day with caregivers and others helping you manage pain and the like. And in fact, you know, from a what we would consider a routine, almost elective surgery, as you described, we actually want to get you out of the hospital as quickly as you can, not just because of cost, but also because we don't want you to sit in the hospital where you might be at risk for developing what we call a nosocomial infection, or something happens to you that is untoward or unexpected as a result of being there. So there's certainly a move for routine care to go and come and go, or same-day surgeries, and increasingly to outpatient. But we also have very sophisticated technical care that requires high-skilled nursing, extraordinary surgical techniques, and equipment that comes along with that, and there's certainly a bricks-and-mortar cost for doing that.
Mm-hmm. I want to be sure and ask you, Dr. Hernandez, as we debate the healthcare reform in the country, are there parts of what is happening in San Francisco that would be applicable to making healthcare in this country better?
Well, I think it's a great question. First from a constituency point of view, San Francisco, when we convened this group at the San Francisco Foundation and hosted these meetings, you know, we had advocates, we had healthcare leaders, we had healthcare providers, we had health foundations, and really importantly, we had the business community at the table. And it was very easy to say, here's the goal. Let's get everybody in our system. The value was there. It was, whether it was motivated by costs or ER overcrowding, everybody felt that that was the goal that we should do and that was achievable. And I think, you know, that's got to be lesson one, which is that systemic healthcare reform is achievable in this country. And everybody who, you know, there's a lot of what, you know, people refer to as special interests or constituents or components of the system that, of course, are concerned with what reform does to them, and legitimately so. But at the same time, I think it's really important for people to stay in the conversation and not walk away and say, well, this may hurt my industry in this fashion. And what we've seen thus far is, you know, the health insurance companies have some extraordinary leaders that have stayed at the table in these conversations. The business community, we've got great champions in the business community for healthcare reform. Obviously, we've got huge advocates for universal coverage. So I think that's principle one, and really you shouldn't shortchange that, because there are people who would just assume to leave things just as they are and let the chips fall where they may and let it happen on somebody else's watch. And I think as a country, all of us need to say, what can I do to make this better?
Mm-hmm.
That's one. Two is, we started with everybody was going to need to give something. This is a really important principle that, as we sat around the table, it wasn't that we were just going to hit business for a business tax. It wasn't that we were going to ask, you know, the hospitals who are bulging at the seams and have ER overcrowding and the like, and just them to do it. This is really something where, as we talked about earlier, there's a consumer role. There is take responsibility for wellness for yourself and for your family, and get a plan for primary prevention and staying healthy. And everybody having something to give is really important in this discussion on national health care reform. There are people who say, well, you know, individuals who are high utilizers, it's their fault that they're sick and they should do something. Well, that's not always true. I mean, there are people who develop autoimmune diseases. There are children who are born with childhood malignancies. Nothing that they have done has put them in that situation, and we shouldn't allow people to go bankrupt because there was a very interesting story on one of your affiliates the other day. As you know, Healthy Families in this state is the SCHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program. And because we had a state deficit, for a period of time they stopped enrolling in our Children's Health Insurance Program. And so suddenly you have kids who were eligible for a program that went on a wait list. And this young woman who's a high school basketball star said, you know, my family runs a small business. We can't afford health insurance. I was trying to enroll in SCHIP. I got put on the wait list, and I couldn't decide if I should play basketball because if I broke my leg or I got really hurt, I didn't want to create a financial burden on my family. These are not the kinds of considerations we should have for 14-year-old basketball stars.
Who want to play basketball.
Yeah,
Dr. Hernandez, we're out of time. Thank you so much. You were a marvelous guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, continued success with the program. Dr. Sandra Hernandez, who is Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Foundation. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios for all of your calls. Thank you as well. We have news coming up, and we'll return with another hour of Wednesday Conversation here on the Ideas Network.